The practice of Zen, that is the practice that leads to the life that we all have as a potential, is a mysterious process. It is tempting to try to figure it out and to try to determine how to do it and all the rest of it. But like all of our life, it is a mysterious process. We do not know, for example, what will happen tomorrow. We may have plans for tomorrow, we may have made appointments for tomorrow, we may have done all kinds of things which we believe determines tomorrow. But we all know, having lived the length of time we have, that the best laid schemes of mice and men, as they say, come, and many things occur that we had no, we could not have predicted. This is so not just for each day, but it is also so for the course of our life. We might be able to justify or comfort ourselves by saying, well, the reason I started this was because this and that. But really, when you look at it, it's really quite mysterious. And why did you start this and that? And what led you to that? And so on. And if you really are honest about it, you know that it's within a vast mystery. We have to respect that mystery. We have to let it help us not to be arrogant nor turn ourselves in the wrong orientation towards our life by thinking that we can figure it all out and determine things. Because the problem with that is, of course, that if life turns out the way we've projected it, then we feel momentarily happy. But for the most part, it won't turn out that way because there's many parameters that we were quite unaware of. And then we get disappointed, or we get self-deprecatory, or we get blaming, or we do other things. And this is the course of ordinary life. Zen turns in quite a different way. As a member of my extended family, that whenever you ask her, or often when you ask her something, you know, how have you just about finished with that? And she'll say, pretty much, pretty much. And is your daughter doing well in that new class? Pretty much. And this pretty much is an example of how we're not, we allow our minds to do things that will be, as we say in the our little phrase, that it's good enough for government work. Most people don't demand beyond a certain point to know what's going on. And one way they, we could look at it, they float within a group of vague concepts and ideas, and they tolerate the mind building structures and stories to explain things without often updating the explanations or checking with the reality outside to see if it really accords with what's going on. Everyone or most people have an idea of everybody that they think they know. And they think that the idea they have of that person is actually that person. But they have, that has to be tempered with the knowledge that each person and each thing and each event in life is the product of a vast mystery. And by that vast mystery, I mean it's the product of causes and conditions, causal forces of all sorts, most of which are not available to us in our conscious mind. The only ones that we work with to build our explanations and our stories are those which we allow through the filters of our conscious mind. And we do that because of comfort, because of wanting aids to navigate through the world and so on. It's not It's not without its value. But Zen is so different from that. And it has to be realized that it's different from that. In order to really engage with this great practice of Zen, which audaciously the Buddha from the beginning and all the Zen masters have pointed out that it leads to the end of suffering. The end of suffering. And the end of the fear of death, for example. And the possibility of great compassion, great love, great engaged enjoyment, you might say, of each day. There are all kinds of books and workshops and so on that offer to teach people how to do these things. But if they are based upon, as are most of them, I would hesitate to say all of them, but certainly the large majority, 99%, who knows, I've not surveyed the field, so I can't give an accurate figure, but many, many, many are based on having a set of ideas that you try to live by. A set of insights and so on, some of which may be very useful. But for one prime reason, they are limited. And they can never lead to the fullness of life which the practice of Zen allows us to do. And that prime single reason is that they are based on conceptualizing a life, or your own life, or what's possible for you. And the very conceptualization of it is to place it outside and something that you don't have. That's a simple idea. But it's hard to really take it in thoroughly. That every time that you conceptualize your life or a possibility for you, you are simply generating it out of what we call duality. That is, a divided nature. As the Buddha pointed out, this is the fundamental source of our suffering, of our ignorance, of our aggression, of our greed, all these things. This is a fundamental reason for it. And it is inherent in human beings. It is, we might say, our nature. So the practice of Zen works with this very thing that is fundamental to our nature. We don't need to go into now the values and evolution of this, we might say, fact of our ordinary being. It's not a bad thing, but it's a thing that we primarily deal with in the practice of Zen. Because in penetrating through the products of this duality, we come to what we call in Zen our fundamental nature. And that fundamental nature is not divided. That fundamental nature is one with all things. As Zen Master Dogen so audaciously put it, he said, "You are mountains and rivers, the whole wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars." This is absolute nonsense to the mind that thinks in a divided way. And Dogen was pointing to something. He was not speaking of the so-called objective world. The objective world is what comes about when we talk about the world, when we conceptualize the world, and so on. It's a world fundamentally based on the idea that it is outside of us, and that includes ourselves. How often do people say to themselves, "I don't know why I did that, something got into me. I had an anxiety attack." Think about it. Or, "That wasn't me, I don't do that, that's not who I am. Something just got into me." Not uncommon for folks to speak that way. All of which is a sign of the divided being, even within ourselves. This is fundamental to human nature. And it is with that fundamental quality of human nature that we deal in the practice of Zen. So, the common outcome of not dealing with it is pretty much what? Pretty much letting the thoughts pull us around. Pretty much not questioning any of those things. Not questioning that those thoughts are just events that came in that we didn't predict, and then they come into our conscious mind, and not realizing that they, because they weren't invited, they're actually none of our business. But there might be something important there, because they're mine, they came into my mind. All this nonsense we have to look into, inquire, inquire, inquire. So the practice of Zen begins with this desire to go deeper, find out. Not to just live a life that's pulled and pushed around by these things. As I was speaking to someone just the other day, and she referred to it as the pull and the push of egos. That is not something that occurs very frequently to people. They are content to live a life that is about the things and the events and the accomplishments and the things that bring pleasure or avoid pain and so on. Nothing wrong with any of that, of course. But to have the idea that that's the whole of life, it is uncommon for folks to contemplate that maybe it's not. And moreover, to contemplate that if they really went towards what life is really all about and how to deal with that, they would not, in fact, lose any of the other capacities to enjoy things, to plan trips, to do all the rest of things that are the products of the properly used dualistic mind. But this is something else. Now, I would say that in Zen, as many of you know, we speak of transmission. And transmission is the is usually referred to as the moment or time when a student comes to, what do we say, realization, or for themselves knowing this other side of life with their teacher, and it's called a transmission. It's a little bit of a misnomer, because nothing is handed over. It's more of a validation, an acknowledgement of this in the other person. And because there are many things that we can, because of our hunger, we can take to be enlightenment or take to be realization, it's necessary to have a teacher who has been around the block a while and has themselves come to this realization and gone far beyond it, in order to protect ourselves from what we often see in various other so-called spiritual paths, including many churches who will, many of the participants will make a big deal out of their, quotes, conversion and all that sort of thing, and still turn out to be the troubled beings and the resenting beings that they were all along. Because the operation of duality has not been broken through. It is something where you get high on something and you are so hungry for the establishment of what you and who you really are that you take that as being what you are, who you are, what the world is really all about. And it's not in itself a bad thing, except sometimes it leads to horrible things, like fundamentalism. And you get it in all kinds of areas and places. The dangerous thing about any fundamentalist is that they think they know the truth, and that therefore that makes them superior and justifies objectifying the rest of people who, unfortunately for them, do not know the truth. So it justifies the activities that we hear too often about the Taliban and so on. But it occurs in our country, as everybody knows who reads the news. Frequently, commonly, and it feels like more and more. But at any rate, that's just the product of what we human beings are until we start to question a bit deeper and go underneath. So I might say the first real transmission, if we could extend the term transmission, to something that happens within oneself that moves one to a different mode of relationship with their experience. Not just the big transmission, you might say, that is ordinarily spoken of in Zen, but even this point of turning away from being pulled and pushed around by the mind. A person upon certain upon some reflections, and if they give them themselves time for that reflection, which is not so common today, but maybe it may become more common as we accelerate the practice of endlessly trying to entertain ourselves with endless applications on our iPads and our cell phones and all kinds of things. We may get to the point, which I believe has been one of the salient facts about, what do we say, American spirituality, is that people have followed this road of excess to the point where it may lead to the palace of wisdom. And so people may stop and say, is this all that life is? They may. I'm not saying they will, but they may. So I can't say whether this prevalence of all these entertainments and distractions is a good thing or a bad thing. It is just what it is, and it was inevitable given the unfoldment of the history of technology and so on. But here we are. And the first so-called transmission, I would say, is when a person gets to the point that maybe there's something underneath, something further, something more. And this commonly gives rise to the question that is so common, what is the meaning of life? That's been up through the centuries. What is the meaning of life? Is the meaning just all this stuff? And unfortunately, in the Western world, there's not been much that will answer that. Philosophy is a failure as far as that is concerned. And so on. People go and study psychology, and very often it turns about that they have been studying ratology, about how rats behave. Maybe that's not inappropriate. But they don't learn about what the meaning of life is. What is this about a human being? What's fundamentally possible for a human being? Well, there have been times when psychological approaches have promoted that and have helped it and so on. But all based upon a conceptualization of a person and how to make that person better, more compassionate, more humane, more wise, or whatever it may be. And because it's based on that conceptualization, it's based upon separation. And because it's based on separation, it will never arrive at the ultimate possibility of a human being. So a new way has to be found. So as I say in this first transmission, it may be that a person starts to observe the thoughts instead of being pulled around by the thoughts. And so in the practice of Zen, we urge this as a fundamental practice to witness, as though they weren't yours at all. Just observe them the way you would observe cars going down the street. I remember when I was a little kid, I used to go beside a busy street. I'd sit on the grass and I have a little pad with me, and I don't know why I did it, but obviously it trained my mind in some way. I would watch the cars going by and I would try to get I would try to get their license plate, each car that went by, and I would write it down. Zip, zoom, I'd write it down. Zip, I'd write it down. I don't know why I did that. Anyhow, it's a matter of observing these thoughts, feelings, memories, fantasies, and so on that come through the mind without getting their license plate number. Just notice them. They're coming by. The way you might notice leaves falling in autumn. You just notice them. And in a sense, you'd say, autumn's here. This is so characteristic of autumn. Falling leaves. So you'd notice your mind and you'd notice, look what's happening in there. In comes this thought, it gets elaborated, it builds. Oh, there's another one comes in. Oh, there's that feeling, there's that memory, there's that. And you just let them come in and go out. Very different from having them come in and then you ruminate upon them. You find their license plate number, not only that, where the carburetor was manufactured. And just witnessing them that way. Already, if that practice is developed and continued, develops a whole different level of peace in the being. And if it is applied to the people that you observe, including yourself, it starts to develop a level of compassion. And that's based upon letting people be the way they are. That same person I was speaking to the other day who spoke of the pull and push of egos said that for her, she had had this experience that the world seemed to flatten out, as it were. There weren't all the blips of individual things, but there was some sameness started to creep in. The sameness of us human beings on the planet. This is what we do. This is what minds do, as I tell students all the time. You have a resident mind, and minds do that. These thoughts arise, and then they fall away, and memories come in, and they go out. You didn't choose to have them. You didn't intend it. It doesn't serve any particular structured function that you were engaged in life. They just come, and they go, and they come, and they go. You develop compassion, a quietness, a peace, even while engaging in the busy world. And a certain wisdom starts to grow also. An awareness of something beyond the attractive individual entertainments. But the fact of what it is in the mind that hungers for these entertainments and how they actually function for you. So this is a very important first step. Eventually, you may have the good fortune to encounter the Dharma and encounter a way of working with this mind in order to come to realize what fundamentally you fundamentally are. And it's not all the ideas you had about yourself. This is a wonderful thing. It's a rare thing. Especially if it brings you to practice under some good guidance. In Zen we say, it's like, and this is meant to point out how precious it is, that it's like there was a piece of wood floating in the vast ocean with a hole in it, and there's a blind turtle swimming in the ocean. And one day, the blind turtle finds this piece of wood and puts its head up through the hole. We say, to encounter and practice the Dharma is as rare as that. Therefore, it is highly precious. Now, every analogy does not need to be carried just to any explanatory or intellectual extreme, but simply acknowledge how rare and precious it is. How rare and precious it is that you encountered that book at that particular time, or that particular word, or that particular, you happened to hear that conversation going on. Like the sixth patriarch, who was supporting his mother by cutting firewood and selling it. He was walking along one day with a load of firewood, and he encountered a monk who was standing there reciting a piece of the Diamond Sutra. And as he went by, he heard the monk say, "Arouse the mind that abides nowhere." And that struck him so deeply. It brought him to a kind of realization. And then he continued from there to find the fifth patriarch and undertake his training, and on it goes. But that little incident, it was unplanned. It was not part of a strategy. That rare and precious moment that initiated something that you had not guessed was possible for you. With Wei Nung, sixth patriarch, it led to the flourishing of this enormous, insightful practice, the bringing out of the shadows, the core of the teaching of the Buddha throughout the Tang Dynasty, giving rise to many great teachers and much literature that we use all the time now, that come from, that came from their teaching. This little moment. Well, let me go and talk now about the second patriarch, Weka. Weka was, as a young man in China, he was, and I'm speaking now time-wise, the late 400s of our era in China. As a young man, he was always attracted to kind of an inward life, and he loved to be out in nature and experience the phenomena of nature. He loved to roam in the fields and the forests. And then as he got a bit older, into teenage, he started to read the Chinese classics, the poetry, Confucius, Kung Fu Tzu, and Taoism, and so on. And he was very attracted by these things, and they somehow really resonated with him. Eventually, as he moved on, late teenage, early 20s, he went and visited many of the great lecture masters, as they used to be called, in Mahayana and Hinayana Buddhism. He listened to their talks and was learned more and more. For some reason, and I don't know why, maybe it's not recorded, at age 23 he began sitting what we'd call Zazen. Zazen did not exist as a name at that time, but he began sitting like that and starting to inquire into his being. Well, the great Bodhidharma arrived in China around the year 520 in our era, from India, in his 90s, taking, as we say, the slow boat to China from the south of India, taking 3 years through the turbulent seas and the other kind of afflictions of that region of the world. And he arrived in China and We don't need to go into the story, particularly, which in itself is just most marvelous, of Bodhidharma's interviews and interactions with the Emperor Wu of Liang. But he eventually ended up in the northern part of China, and he sat, as they say, facing a wall in a cave. Not many people showed up, but eventually one or two did, and then three or four, and finally maybe half a dozen, and wanting to be taught by this person who had come from India, bringing the core teaching of the Buddha. And he'd mumble a few things to these people and so on, but basically encouraging them to sit. Well, one day, this older man, Weka, who had been through and he'd been sitting and he'd studied all the Chinese classics and all the rest of it, he came, and I don't know what his age was then, but maybe his late 20s, and he came to Bodhidharma, and he asked to be taught by Bodhidharma. Because he had explored all the Mahayana and Hinayana teachings, and he had read all the classics, and it wasn't there for him. He couldn't get it. There was something that was missing, something that was fundamental that he was drawn to. But he didn't get it yet. He knew there was something there to get, but he didn't know how or what it was. But he was drawn by it, just as he was in his youth, by his inward life and by his affinity with nature, and it was something that was drawing him on. So Bodhidharma, compassionately, though it may not sound very compassionate, said to Weka, this matter that you want, is only the product of great devotion, hard work, enduring, and doing what is hard to do, and enduring what is hard to endure, and persisting without thought of time. How can someone, such a barbarian as yourself, with so little virtue and such arrogance, ever think that this is possible for you? Then he turned back and started to face the wall again. Now, many folks these days, if they were greeted by a teacher in that fashion, you can imagine what their response would be. Not so for Weka. Weka knew there was something. And there was something that Bodhidharma knew and manifested in his life that was what he, Weka, was seeking all his life. And so he continued. And he sat and he sat and he sat. And one day, there was heavy snow. And the story goes, and we don't know if it is legend or if it actually occurred, but it is always told in the annals of Zen that Weka came once again to Bodhidharma, stood outside his cave in the falling snow until the snow was up to his knees. And he said to Bodhidharma, please teach me. Please, bring my mind to peace. Pacify my mind. Bodhidharma didn't respond. Weka then took out a sword and cut off his left arm. Laid it on the snow in front of Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma. Again, with great compassion. And realizing that this man, Weka, was ripe, as we say in Zen. He was on the edge. He had exhausted everything else. Said to him, well then, bring forth that mind, and I will pacify it. And Weka said, I have searched and searched for this mind, and I cannot find it. And Bodhidharma then is reputed to have said, there, it is pacified for you. Now, somewhere along the line of our practice, when we have experienced all the wonderful things that come from letting thoughts come and go, when we have experienced peace, a certain level of peace, a certain growth of wisdom, where we have a larger view of what human beings and ourselves are, a certain compassion that comes from that knowing and seeing, many people will settle for that. That's wonderful. If that were the case, it would have a strong influence, if there were many, many such people, a strong influence on the course of human history. Reduction of aggression and so on. But Weka knew there was something more. He was not satisfied. It was then, a matter of speaking, a divine dissatisfaction. How many folks are willing to dwell with that divine dissatisfaction, with that fundamental not knowing, and yet knowing there is something to know that would draw them on? Weka was such a person. And with that spirit of inquiry to the very bottom of his mind, until he truly came, we sometimes speak of it as the dark night, the place where there is absolute not knowing, that you still persist and you stretch. And you hurl yourself into this abyss of not knowing. Then, suddenly, the world opens up. Suddenly, you see, you hear, you smell, you taste. You feel what the world really is and who you really are. But in fact, you realize that all your suffering and all your fears were the product of this conceptualizing mind, living by a story of your life and a story of what is, versus the actual experience of, as we say in Zen, just this. Shakyamuni, the legend tells us, upon awakening, said, and it's often translated in this way, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. I was looking at the Chinese the other day, and the way I choose to translate that from now on is, above. Above the heavens and below the heavens. Just this. This, just this, is beyond all conceptualization. It is not an it, nor is there anybody that knows that it. For finally you realize, from a life where there were many its, many things that seemed to be separate, and many selves inside, that now you know there's only one thing. Only one thing. And that one thing is what you are. You suddenly know what Zen Master Dogen meant when he said, you are mountains and rivers, the whole wide earth, the sun, the moon, and the stars. You suddenly know. But the root of all suffering has been cut. That the fear of death is just the merest memory. And you reach what we call in Zen true freedom. And then you lead the life that is yours. The life that has been determined by your karma. And you live it thoroughly as this moment. As one of the Zen masters said, it's the self, realizing the self by living out the self of now. How can that be conceptualized? It cannot. Because the very conceptualization separates us from it. For there is only one, not two, not multiple realities. There is only one. And all the disparate things in the world are seen at that moment as being manifestations of this single thing that shines in everything, as it were, with its own light. And I don't mean anything hokey. I don't mean auras. I don't mean anything like that. But you see them just as if a clear light was shone upon everything in the world, including yourself. Do you see it? You hear it, you smell it, you taste it, you touch it. This one thing, and all things, are one thing. What a mystery. So this process begins in mystery. And it ends by knowing and identifying and hurling yourself into this mystery with great joy. So we don't know whether we could cut off his arm or not. But we know that he was very persistent. And this persistence is something that we need to cultivate in our being. Everyone who is serious about the practice of Zen must cultivate that mystery. And engage in this practice, which as you undertake the practice, you realize it had no actual beginning. And it also has no end. It's all about being honest about things. Looking at your life and seeing how we comfort ourselves with having beginnings and endings of things and explaining everything. But if we're just honest, we realize there's a vast mystery. And we don't know a lot of things, nor do we have to explain because our explanatory structures and ideas are all in the light of this one reality, just paltry toys. So this path that you have undertaken is the most marvelous path. It's a path that you cannot conceptualize the goal, the end, nor identify the beginning. But it is a path that you walk. And as you walk it, everything unfolds and everything occurs, as long as you follow it and just walk it. The teaching of Zen is a vast tradition of how to do that, inspired as best we can by those who have actually followed that path and come to the realization and refined it. Based upon also the wisdom of all those folks that have gone before us. As we go, please allow the great spirit of inquiry to develop in you, deeply wonder. And don't settle for anything that you can explain or put words on, but deeply wonder and stretch and walk on. We'll end there today.